Chapter 10, Profile of a Killer. We're now entering the last and most incredible phase of Paul Hull's investigation into the Golden State Killer. When Paul's suspect Mitch was eliminated, Paul was ready to throw in the towel and quit the case entirely. He began investigating this case 24/7, 365 back in 2011. Now it's 2017. There isn't enough maker's mark in the world to drown out Paul's frustration. But he's not quitting. He's obsessed. Which is why he develops a revolutionary idea. The use of genealogy to fish for the Golden State Killer's name. But before Paul calls genealogist Barbara Ray Venter and heads down this exciting path, let's take a moment to look at who the Golden State Killer really is. What do we know about him at this point in the investigation? The answer is a lot. Paul, it's great to see you.
It's good to see you, Jim.
The Golden State Killer started his first crime spree in 1974, breaking into houses in Visalia, California, when no one was home. Visalia was a small, isolated town of 30,000 people in the heart of California's agricultural San Joaquin Valley. Windows could be found open during hot summer days. Doors were left unlocked. It was the perfect playground for a burglar.
1974 in Visalia, California, a series of burglaries were starting to be committed by an offender that became known as the Visalia Ransacker. This was an individual that was going into houses, typically with nobody inside the house. He wanted to go into the women's undergarments, and he often would take these women's undergarments and lay them out on the bed or just throw them around the house. He'd go through looking for jewelry items, but often would just take silly things such as piggy banks, blue chip stamps, and single earrings as souvenirs. His MO was to break into these houses when nobody was home. During the course of this series, he was highly prolific. He committed over 100 known burglaries in a matter of about a year and a half. But around a little more than two-thirds the way through this series, he escalated. 16-year-old Beth Snelling is asleep in her bed, and she wakes up, and the Visalia Ransacker is laying on top of her, and he's got his hand over her mouth. He proceeds to pull her out of her bed, and she's struggling with him. He pulls her out of her house, but her father, Claude Snelling, hears this commotion and runs to his daughter's rescue. The Visalia Ransacker heard Claude coming towards him. He lets go of Beth Snelling, pulls a gun out, and shoots Snelling. Claude Snelling is killed. At this point, Visalia Ransacker kicks Beth three times in the head and runs off.
Unlike his later murders when he's premeditating his attacks, he's reacting here. But his murder of Claude Snelling shows he will kill if he has to. His attempt to pull Beth out of the house suggests he's on a path to becoming the East Area Rapist. It makes me wonder whether he committed other sexual assaults during this time period that we just don't know about.
Yeah, well, that sounds like an unplanned event. He didn't think this out in advance, and perhaps he was surprised to find someone in there and just reacted impulsively at the time.
That's right. Visalia PD is actively investigating this Ransacker series, as you would expect, especially now since it appears that this guy is willing to kill. Officer Roger McGowan, who is the primary investigator for Visalia PD, at one point accurately predicts where the Ransacker is likely to hit next. So Officer McGowan stages himself in a garage at a house, and at a certain point at nighttime, he sees the Ransacker across the street, up on the side of a house, go in front of the house, and then start to go into the backyard through the fence gate. Officer McGowan goes and confronts the Ransacker at that gate. He's got his flashlight out, shining it on the Ransacker, whose back is to him. The Ransacker turns around, ends up pulling out a gun and shooting Officer McGowan. Fortunately for McGowan, the bullet strikes his flashlight and McGowan is saved, yet the Ransacker is able to escape. This is in the end of December of 1975. At this point, no other burglaries or other cases are attributed to the Visalia ransacker.
Police officers can get overwhelmed with tips, and sometimes they have to rely on their gut to choose which leads to follow first. Sounds like Officer McGowan had pretty good gut instincts. Murder and attempted murder of a police officer are obviously two of the most serious crimes a person can commit. But most of the crimes that the Visalia ransacker committed were petty break-ins. Did this juvenile behavior continue when the ransacker became the East Area Rapist?
When you start talking about juvenilistic behavior, now you get further into the East Area Rapist series. Attack number 30 on the official list. Again, two teenage girls that he goes into the house when their parents are gone. And during that attack, at a certain point, he stomps out of the room and he's saying, "I want to stop. She's making me do this. Mommy, mommy, mommy."
Really?
And you go, now is he just pretending to make these types of statements? Or is that really what he's experiencing, what he's feeling?
Well, one of the things we know about serial offenders and most offenders is that they play these offenses out in advance in their mind. They fantasize about it. They build up to actually doing the offenses. Many times they'll stalk their victims, they'll stake out the place, they'll know exactly what they want to do, and then they'll go back and enjoy fantasizing about it. And that fantasy is always perfect. Right. There are no flaws in the fantasy. But when it comes to the real world, when they're actually acting on those fantasies, when they're actually trying to fit this current victim into that fantasy, typically things go wrong. And that can get them very frustrated. So that might be what happened in that case. Because he set up this fantasy, and he wanted it to be this way, and it wasn't that way.
Yeah, and that makes sense. He's fantasizing about the perfect scenario. When things don't go right, that's when they have some issues. Mm-hmm. In one attack, after he pulled this 15-year-old girl out of her house down a canal, and he gets to a point where he's cut off her jeans, and he's thinking possibly that she was an American River College student, and when it's turning out, no, she's a high school student, and there's a possibility he confused her for a neighbor, he ends up pushing away from her and makes a statement, "This isn't going right." He never sexually assaults her, he ends up just leaving.
Paul, I have here the original FBI profile done in 1977 of the East Area Rapist. The original FBI profilers, whom are my close friends, colleagues, and mentors, began interviewing incarcerated serial killers to gain a better understanding of their thinking. Their hope was to use that information to catch active serial killers. So reading this profile, it starts out, first one is white male. A lot of people say, well, you always say white male. Well, that's absolutely not true, actually, because there certainly have been serial killers and serial rapists of all races, or right, of all ethnicities. And so we look at the victimology to reflect back and determine what race the offender is. And for particular types of crimes, offenders don't necessarily cross racial lines, but other crimes they do. And you just have to know the nuances that tell you the difference. They say the subject is either unemployed or employed in a job requiring minimum contact with the public. Unskilled or semi-skilled labor, basically. So why do you think the profile determined that he would be sort of underemployed, that it would be sort of low-skill jobs and occupations?
When you read the case file, he's making statements when he's entering the house. "I'm here for your food and money. I need food and money," as if he doesn't have a job, as if he's unemployed, and he's moving around the countryside and is having to attack just to survive. Part of this is his MO, because he's trying to put the victims at ease as, "I'm just trying to, you know, I'm not here to hurt you. I just need your food and money, and I'll leave you alone." But he would also do behaviors like sit there and shake as if he were undergoing withdrawals from drugs. So he's doing this verbal staging, and I know when I initially read these case files, I kind of bought into that those staged statements, and I'm going, I'm looking at a guy who's younger, who is sort of this, what I call the troll under the bridge type of offender.
Right, but once you figure out that that's staging, it raises the level of his forensic sophistication and his criminal sophistication. The fact that he's not driving up to the residences of the victims that he's picking, but actually, whatever vehicle he's using, he's parking it a distance away, and he's approaching on foot, quietly. The fact that they wake up and he's already standing there over them with a mask over his face, with a knife in his hand, exposed, half naked. Those are all things that are definitely part of his fantasy. And the people that plan and execute fantasies like this, very sophisticated fantasies, are usually of higher intelligence. So, Paul, I have here the updated profile done by the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit in 2013. And in contrast to the 3 pages from 1977, this is 29 pages of comprehensive analysis. There's a lot more nuance to it. That's because the original team, Douglas, Ressler, Hazelwood, they interviewed about 35 offenders. By the time I went through the unit, that number was over 1,500.
Wow.
So in 2013, who knows how many they've interviewed by now.
It's a lot more data that they're working
with. Oh, absolutely. One of the first things they talk about is victimology and the choice of victim. So we know that offenders pick victims based on availability, vulnerability, and desirability. And if someone is available and vulnerable, and they can't find the desirable victim, they'll pick whoever they can. And sometimes offenders will just randomly pick victims. Somebody like Israel Keyes did that. He sort of set a trap, and whoever fell into that trap would be his next victim. But others are very focused on a particular victim at a particular place in a particular time for a particular purpose. And so I believe this killer, the Golden State Killer, actually was the latter. I think he actually picked his victims. He chose them carefully, and then he built a fantasy around them, and then he tried to act out that fantasy.
Right. One notable case, the very first case where there's a man present, he's having the woman put on high heel shoes and get on top of him and straddle him on the sofa. And he's manipulating her like he's been fantasizing about what he's wanted to do for her for a while. Versus in some of the cases, he's very derogatory to the female victim. He's kicking them in the sides. He's not doing all this other type of manipulation. It is straight missionary style sex where he never lets his body down onto the victim. And I've kind of dug into that thinking he may have some of these women where he's seen from afar and he's been fantasizing about, but then other cases where there's that anger, that power and control that he wants to exhibit, and that is the primary motivation in those.
So when we look at the East Area Rapist and look at the type of offender he is, we know that we break down rape typologies into 4 major categories. You have power reassurance rapists, you have power assertive rapists, you have anger retaliatory rapists, and you have anger excitation rapists. Power reassurance rapists, basically, they typically treat the crimes they commit, the rapes they commit, as dates.
Yeah.
And they will actually, in their minds, set up a situation where they are actually just dating this woman. And they typically will use weapons only to control and not to actually hurt the victims. Of course, there's outliers, and sometimes when they're cornered, they will lash out. But in general, they will do things like say, "Can I see you again? Did you enjoy yourself? You should lock your windows at night," and things like that. Get a dog, not a cat.
And that's crazy. In fact, we just had a case solved that I had worked over my career of a power reassurance rapist. The NorCal rapist is a prime example of what you were just describing.
And then the power assertive. These are people that, as you described, take out their anger that exists outside this incident on the individual. And typically that's, "I am powerful and I'm going to prove it to you. And I'm going to prove it to you, I'm going to beat it into you." They're usually more violent, they're more aggressive, and they're domineering. Then we move up to the anger retaliatory. And these are people who are not just trying to control the person, but literally hurt that person. They're carrying around a very severe anger and rage. And then the ultimate category is anger excitation. And this is typically a sadistic type of offender who actually gets off sexually on causing and witnessing the suffering of his victims. Sometimes, so much so that they will forego what we call traditional sexual activity, and they will become sexually aroused and even sexually satisfied by causing and witnessing the pain of others. What typology do you feel the East Area Rapist falls into?
He most certainly was inflicting psychological stress on these victims. He was all about inflicting fear. He's coming in and he's hissing at them through clenched teeth. I've got a gun. If you don't do what I say, I'll blow your brains all over the wall. Anytime they talked, it was, shut up. I'm dominating you, right? Mm-hmm. But he would do things like move silently around the house, and the victims think he's gone. And in one instance, the mother, laying next to her 7-year-old daughter in bed, thinks he's gone and starts talking to the daughter, and the daughter says, shh, mommy. And he's standing right there and pushes down on the bed to let her know, I'm right here, scaring her. I'm seeing an offender that is retaliating against these victims for something that is making him angry in his normal life. Mm. And the victims are a proxy for whatever is making him angry. I do think that earlier in the series, he's more of this power assertive. He wants to express power and control. He's dominating them. He's playing psychological games with them. So I see this spectrum where it does appear that he toggles a little bit between power assertive and anger retaliatory, but I gravitated towards classifying him more in that anger retaliatory category.
Paul, let's discuss MO. It's very clear that the East Area Rapist changes MO significantly over time.
Well, at the very beginning of the series, in June of 1976, the East Area Rapist goes into a house. You've got a young woman asleep in her bed, and she wakes up, and she sees him standing in the doorway. And he's standing there. He's got a T-shirt on. He's got a mask on. He's got a knife in one hand. He's erect. She's nude from the waist down.
Yeah.
He jumps on the bed, puts the knife to her temple, and says, I want to fuck you. Mm. Over the course of the next 15 attacks, you see him experimenting. In the very next case, after that first case, he's attacking two teenage girls.
What is his goal in taking two victims? Is it proving to himself that he can overpower two people at the same time? Does that help him feel more powerful?
I think it does, but it also was telling me, well, this guy's done more cases than we know about. And that's one of the factors where I've used over time thinking, he's older than what most people think. This is not a teenage boy. Mm. He's done more cases, and now he has the confidence to take on two girls at the same time.
What about the plates? He would pile plates on the back. He would have the husband lay on the ground, pile plates on his back, and tell him, if you move, if I hear these plates, I'm going to kill your wife.
Yep. Or I'll kill everything in this house if there's children in the house.
And in the end, did he ever kill those men?
Down in Southern California, he did kill the men. Now, in those instances, we don't have any evidence that he had put plates on their back. He went into those bedrooms knowing he was going to kill those men. So it appears he's changing his MO once he escalates up to homicide. In the earlier cases, he's using those plates as an alarm system. Mm-hmm. Most certainly, that is physically torturous for these men who have their hands bound behind their back, their ankles bound, and now they have plates on their back and they can't move at all.
They know their wife is being raped, and they know they have to be perfectly still. No matter how much they want to fight and try to get free so that they can save their wife, they can't do it. And how demeaning.
Paul, as we sit here today, what's your biggest unanswered question about the Golden State Killer?
I have to know, what was motivating him internally? What was he feeling that drove him to go out and do these fetish burgs in Visalia, ultimately become the East Area Rapist and attack these women? And then why was he doing some of the almost ritualistic things with the women in terms of how he's binding them up? Because he always did that consistently. And he had a signature sexual component to his attack. Where did he get that from? Is that coming from something in his background? Did he experience something like that? Or was this something that he read about and fantasized about, like in those True Detective magazines?
Mm. Yeah, you know what I'd like to ask him?
What's that?
Why did you stop?
Yeah.
Why did you do it for so many years? Why did you rape so many women and kill so many people? And then all of a sudden, just stop.
Yes. You see some of these other serial killers who were prolific, such as Green River Killer. Mm. And then they did stop. Why? And then you hear about Gary Ridgway, and when he was asked that question by, I believe it was Mary Ellen O'Toole from the FBI, and he looked at her and he said, oh, I got married. His life changed.